Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking. The podcast's been growing really well lately, so welcome on board to any new listeners and thank you to anyone who's been with us for a while. It always makes me feel super happy when I get messages from you guys and girls letting me know that you're enjoying the podcast, so keep them coming and I'm glad you're enjoying what we're doing. If you want to help us out, there's a few things you can do. We've got some t-shirts available now. You can head over to our shop, downtimepodcast.com/shop, and grab yourself one there. That helps us keep the podcast going, keep funding what we're doing. You can subscribe to the podcast and you can join our newsletter to keep in touch. Again, there's a page on the website, downtimepodcast.com/subscribe, to help you with all of that. And you can give us a follow on social media, where we're Downtime Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, and Downtime Tweets on Twitter. Get involved in the conversation. Let us know what you think. Let us know who you'd like to hear from, what kind of stuff you want to hear about. Always willing to do our best to get guests on that you want to hear from. All right, this week we've got Lewis Kirkwood. Lewis is a pretty good rider in his own right. He's raced cross-country and enduro up to EWS level. But more recently, he's been doing a degree in sports and exercise science. And he's following that up with a PhD in performance in enduro mountain biking. So this man understands the physical demands of enduro inside out. He's been studying some of the top 10 EWS riders. He's had them in the labs. He's taking data from them and from the bikes. Some super interesting stuff here. It's a little bit different from some of our other episodes, but hopefully it'll give you a good insight into what it would take to compete at that level and maybe how you can improve your performance and your riding as well. So without further ado, here's Lewis Kirkwood. Lewis Kirkwood, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for taking time out to come on.
Hi, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
Good stuff. So before we get stuck into the meat of this one, give us a bit of background. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
25 years old. I'm in my final year of my PhD at Edinburgh Napier University, and I've been racing bikes for the past 12 years. Started with cross country, had a year out with glandular fever and a little bit of overtraining, and then on the way back from that, started racing enduro.
Nice. So you've been racing at a pretty high level, right?
Sort of, yeah. I was at the first year of EWS in 2013. I went out to Punta Ala, Val de Sur and Finale, and could manage to sort of creep inside top 60 on stages and sometimes overall. But really, we just couldn't believe how fast the top guys went. And I guess that's what spurred my interest for my research. So.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what you studied in your first degree.
So my undergrad, again, at Edinburgh Napier, I did sport and exercise science, and that's where I met my current director of studies, Geraint Florida James, who's just had a bit of context, currently trains Lou Buchanan, the EWS rider. And my honours project for that was the physiological demands of enduro mountain biking. So I got to go to a race and use some nice GPS accelerometer technology and have some top riders in the lab as well. Because at that point in time, we didn't have any scientific evidence or knowledge about what makes a top enduro racer, what are the physiological characteristics of those guys. So it was really cool to get to do that as an honors project.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really exciting. And that's led on to you to doing a pretty interesting PhD. Tell us a little bit about the topic that you've chosen for that.
Yeah, so as PhDs go for mountain biker, when this one was advertised, it was performance in enduro mountain biking, the influence of sleep, training status and recovery. And I think my heart skipped a beat when that went online, because the description of the project was just everything I could have hoped for. And so for the past 2 and a bit years, I've been looking at the demands of elite enduro racing, and then also the training load that those guys go through to do what they do, and the influence of that on the body, particularly the immune system, using tools like heart rate variability alongside taking blood and looking at immune cells circulating in the body at different points in the season and at races.
Cool. So tell us a little bit, you know, you see something like that advertised, you get involved and apply and get accepted for it. Where do you start? Like, how do you take a topic like that and decide how you're going to attack it?
Well, that's a really good question. I think with any PhD at first. I was over the moon when I did get the PhD because I was obviously delighted to be able to study a topic that I'm so passionate about. But then you get a little bit of imposter syndrome because you realize that you need to know so much about everything. And then, you know, you read a little bit more and realize you know nothing about anything. And then from there, you can start and figure out what you really know and what you really don't know and what it's feasible to know in those next 3 years. So sounds like a lot of mumbo jumbo, but basically had to go about, realistically, we don't know at that point. Apart from my honours project, I knew very little about enduro racing. So we had to go from a standpoint of how do we create a foundation of what makes an elite enduro racer, which is basically what I've published in the last couple of months. And then from there, and draw on the expertise of the team around me to look at ways of measuring training load and looking at the influence of training load in the immune system as time goes on. So that's where the whole team comes to. You're never on your own in a PhD, or very rarely are you on your own in a PhD, and that's where having a really good team around. So at this point, I should mention, I've already said Garrett is a keen mountain biker and coaches Lou, but my second supervisor, Leslie, used to race World Cup cross country, Leslie Ingram. Okay. And my third supervisor is an immunologist. So although it was a very daunting task, and to be honest, still is with 10 months to go, the support around you definitely helps guide you on the way. And a lot of pilot testing as well. So a lot of things in the literature that might work for other sports, you have to try for yourself and see if it's feasible to ask enduro athletes who are flying all around the world trying to race an EWS to do these things or not. Have to learn how to take blood, how to use fancy equipment. So it's a big learning curve, but it's yeah, I guess you have to know what you don't know and then figure it out from there. So
yeah, no, it's super interesting. So tell us a little bit about what you've been up to so far with the PhD. What have you been looking at? What data have you been gathering and looking at, and what have you learned?
So the first sort of hands-on bit of data collection I did was moving on from honors project, really. So I had some top 10 EWS riders in the lab looking at their physiological characteristics. And then I went to a race at Tweedlove and collected some data on using GPS accelerometers. So with those, it's a 10 hertz GPS or 15 hertz GLONASS. It's the updated one with the scarily accurate Russian satellite system. included in that, they also have a 100 hertz accelerometer. So it's a triaxial accelerometer, so you can look at up and down, left and right, forwards and backwards accelerations, and the resultant of those three, the root mean square.
And so the hertz thing is the amount of times it's sampling per second, is that right? So 100 samples a second.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Okay. So with 100 hertz, you get a really good idea of the magnitude of impact and the accumulation of impact. And what we're, I guess, moving on to do next is use some higher frequency equipment to look at hand-arm vibration, which I'll maybe come back to in a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And basically with those, we mounted one on the body of the athlete and one on the bike of the athlete. Just at the seat tube or the seat post, depending on the design of the bike. And then that way we could look at the damping of accelerations between the bike and the body. Uh-huh. And also look at the impacts and accelerations that go that the rider has to absorb, because by the time the head basically has to be kept at relatively low acceleration to maintain cognitive function, as in seeing where you're going and deciding what you're going to do about what you might or might not hit.
Yeah.
Or choosing a line. And also from a point of view of protecting the head and control of the bike, because if you start getting a big donkey nod on, then the chances are you're going to crash. So yeah. So that was really interesting, because the numbers that come off those accelerometers are just way higher than I ever expected they would be. I think the peak that we've seen is about 21 G, which was in a big crash at Fort William. So G being units of acceleration due to gravity. And the reason that, I should go back and say that the sort of mean that we see on the bike for riding enduro tracks is between 2 and 6 G.
Okay.
That's where most of the time is spent.
So
that seemed really high.
So 1 G is the kind of constant gravity, right? That's the baseline, yeah, I suppose, yeah. Right?
Yeah, so then 2G would be trying to hold up double your body weight, 3G, three times your body weight. Yeah. So I thought that was really, really high, to the point that I wasn't really sure if the equipment was working. But then when you go back and look at the files, you can see that it is, and it's just, it's almost instantaneous, because I was speaking to a guy in civil engineering the other day, and he said, 10G, oh, but that's like astronaut level stuff. Like, how do they train for that? But when it's instantaneous, that's fine, because that's the sort of thing you can even get in your car, on a bus, something like that, just little shocks. And that's so yeah, basically that comes back to why you need to be strong to ride a bike, is to mean to withstand all these impacts, which add up over a track to be very significant.
Yeah.
And I guess the interesting part about that, with a lot of mountain biking disciplines, particularly say cross country, you get a high heart rate all the time. And originally, it was sort of assumed that that's all coming from pedaling. But then once we got power meters on the bike, we realized that although you're putting out a lot of power uphill, which explains your really high heart rate, when you're coming back down the hill and you're not pedaling, you still have a really high heart rate. And basically looking at that's where the workload then comes from. So you're having to work to absorb these impacts. So when you're riding technical terrain, that still adds to the workload. So even though you might be able to smash the first couple of turns on a track, you need to have the physiology to back that up to continue doing that all the way down a track. So that was quite interesting from our point of view, to look at quantifying that workload associated with riding technical terrain.
Cool. And so tell us a little bit about the lab-based work. What kind of things have you been measuring with these athletes?
So initially, there's sort of two sides to this. The first set of testing that I did for honors project, and then right at the start of my PhD, we did a ramp test with online gas analysis, meaning that the participant wears what looks like a Bain mask, and it measures oxygen consumption basically against atmospheric air. And you can also get CO, because you know how much oxygen is going in and out, you can also look at CO2 inhaled and exhaled and all sorts of other different cool numbers, but basically you get from that VO2 max, which is what everyone generally seems to know, but you can look at a number of things. And we also did a ramp test looking at blood lactate concentration fixed at 2 and 4 millimoles. So those are your sort of all-day powers, so you can look at that outright in watts, and you can look at that in relative power in watts per kilogram body
weight. So is that that's the amount of watts you can put out kind of whilst lactate's building in the system, or a constant level of lactate? Yeah, I'm trying to understand that one a little bit.
Okay, yeah. So blood lactate gets a bad rep, because it's generally, in the past, has been considered that you want as little of it as possible in the system. But basically, it's always being produced and then reused by your body to create energy again. So you can actually use that lactate to feed it back into the system and get energy. Okay. When you are working aerobically, you can't do it when you're working anaerobically, as far as we know. So we're interested in when the body can no longer start to feed that back into the system to create energy, and it starts to accumulate in the blood. And so once, if resting values are about 1 millimole per liter we see in most, then once we see a rise to 2 and then to 4, we can start seeing that the lactate can no longer be removed from the system and is beginning to accumulate. So at values of 2 and 4, we generally consider that although the value is rising, you can still work for a very long period of time at these power outputs. So it's useful to know how much power you can put out at the point where blood lactate starts to.
And if you go beyond that, is that what people would call lactate threshold, where it start, you start to get a burning in the muscles, or is that even further down the line?
Well, lactate threshold would be a slightly different definition. So the threshold is generally where it begins to accumulate, but it goes under quite a few different names, and you have to be careful with the definition of each, but it's basically the break point. So you'll often see as the workload increases, it will go 1, 1, 1, 1.11, 1.1, and then it might go 1.72, and you have to identify the break point in the curve. So when it stops, it moves away from baseline, because once it moves away, it generally increases exponentially up to exhaustion. That's the word I'm looking for. So they are effectively, for the purpose of this, interchangeable terms. Lactate threshold is the same as fixed at 2 and 4.
Okay, so yeah, that was giving you an idea of how much power these riders can put out, like, pretty much all day then.
Yeah, effectively.
To help them on, well, I guess transition riding and that side of things, getting around a full day of enduro.
Absolutely, yeah. That's something that I think is can be easy to forget about with enduro, the fact that they do have to get between stages. And then it's also useful for riders. You use your body's most efficient at clearing lactate when it's working at its threshold. So it's useful for people who are, when if you want to feed back to information to riders to say, okay, well, you've come in and done this nice test for me, so I can give you this information. Maybe after a stage, they can then go and spin with their heart rate at those values, knowing that they're clearing the lactate out as best it can in preparation for the next stage, because you don't want to hang around for too long. You want to clear it if you can. So that was a nice thing to be able to give back to them. So that was on one day of testing, and then on the next day I designed a repeated sprint test called the EST, which featured a 3-minute stage of sprint intervals, a 15-minute so it meant to be a simulated uphill, simulated transition at 80% of their power lactate threshold at fixed concentration of 4 mmol, and then a 5-minute stage after that, again featuring repeated sprints. Anyone who's done it basically never wants to do it again. And it's also, it's based on something called the DST, the downhill specific test, which was designed by Garrett, my supervisor, when he was working with Chris Ball, who is now as you know, director of EWS, because he did his undergrad at Napier as well. So it all comes back to Napier, it seems. So that's
cool. And what sort of things are you measuring throughout that enduro specific test?
So yeah, I designed the EST for my honors project, and we did it on a Velotron. So it's basically a stationary bike which will measure power output, and you can put what's basically a Wingate crank on it. So it's designed for sprint testing and at power and heart rate. And I measured mean power for all of the sprints. And I also looked at the sprints individually. So what was the max power achieved in each sprint and the mean power achieved in each sprint? And that was basically to get an idea of, the first sprint was about 10 seconds long, and they're all designed to be all out effort. So that was designed to be a sort of max power test included within a bigger set of sprints. And then look at you could look at fatigue index. So do the riders fade away as time goes on in each sprint, or do they get stronger? Or, you know, there's various things you can look at, which is pretty awesome. What else did we do? We also did body composition. So that's 8 skin folds and also thigh girth, 1 centimeter down from, there's no easy way to say this, the bum crease, which gives everyone a laugh, and also grip strength. And the reason we like to include grip strength is we've seen that at Fort William, after one run, you get a decrease of around 30% in grip strength, which is a big decrease. So we like to include that as well. And the thigh girth one was used because the theory being that the bigger your thighs, the more power you can put out, and the more power you can put out, the quicker you can get off the line. So
interesting. And so you did
again, that comes from work that Garrett did.
And you did this on a group of professional kind of EWS level riders and some non-professional as well, is that right?
So I termed them elite and non-elite, but that's basically to give them a name. But so the elite riders were all in the top 40, had finished in the top 40 at EWS. And the non-elite riders either hadn't raced in EWS or were out with the top 100 of EWS races. So I termed them national sort of level riders. And they are good riders. And within there, we did have some, like I was included in the non-elite category. And I'd come from a cross-country background, as had a couple others, and a couple had come from downhill background. So they were good riders.
But still very competitive, but not maybe full-time paid athletes kind of thing. Cool. So what sort of things did you learn then? What were the differences between the two groups?
There's a lot to talk about, really. The The elite rider is the VO2 max, so amount of oxygen you can consume per in mils per kilogram per minute was not actually different between the elite and non-elite riders. So that's the sort of number that people go for in terms of general fitness. What's your VO2 max? They weren't different, but the power that they could produce at their VO2 max was significantly different. So elites could put out a lot more. So for the same oxygen they take in, they could produce a significantly higher amount of power. And
is that likely to be based on like being generally stronger, or do you know why that would be?
I think it would come down to cycling economy. So for the same amount of oxygen, if they're putting out more power, then that would make sense. Basically. So if they've got the same field to peak, but they're putting out more power, then they're going to have a more efficient system is the sort of the gist of it. And that's backed up further by all of their submax powers, so power at 2 and 4 millimole of blood lactate and power at a respiratory exchange ratio of 1, are all higher in elite riders. So they're sort of getting around for all day powers. Their numbers are a lot higher. So although the peak seems to be interesting, it's also a lot about the how much, what percentage of your max can you work at for how long. So it's being able to try and get real close to your max for as long as possible. Because if your stages are sort of 10, 15 minutes long, then you're going to want to be working as close to the top end as you can for as long as possible.
Yeah. And any feel for why there's that big difference between elite and non-elite in those areas, or what it is about the additional work or training that they do that facilitates that?
There's a few things to take into consideration, I suppose. The elite riders are going to have more time to train, so they're going to have theoretically more time to get on their bikes. There's more chance that they've got a coach and a training plan to follow, so that they're going to be guided in what they're doing, which I think is a big part of trying to reach the top of the sport. In terms of how they actually achieve the numbers that they are, particularly the blood lactate system, which I talk about quite a lot, is one of the most trainable systems that there is in the body. So in terms of aerobic and anaerobic and whatever, the glycolytic system, which is the lactate system effectively, is the most trainable. So you're talking interval training generally is the one that's going to be working on that. So I don't know about you, but in terms of recreational sort of general national level riders, interval training isn't the first on my list of things to go and do at the weekend. So
for sure, it's horrible. So
specific training is generally going to be the obvious answer to that one, in that that's how they're going to go and achieve that. So
talk a little bit about the interval side of things. I see people doing kind of interval work in gyms and stuff, and they kind of barely sweating. Like maybe they're, you know, they're having what they would call intense short efforts, interspersed by rest or low effort. But for intervals to work, how would you kind of describe how people should be feeling? Like it's got to be pretty full on, right?
It's going to be pretty full on. But the, I guess, you could have a whole podcast just on interval training, I think. you don't want to just ruin yourself on the first one and then not be able to do what you're trying to do for the next however many you've got in your set. So let's just pick, say you've got 6 intervals to do. You don't want to blow it all on the first one and then just be crawling through the rest of them. You would like to try and keep some sort of, try and maintain it if you can through the session. But on the flip side of that, that takes a bit of skill to get to the end and be burst, but still be putting out a fair effort. And that, I would say that's guided primarily by heart rate, so not necessarily in performance. You do want to be trying to reach that. If you've set yourself a goal, then to get through that session with a fairly even heart rate for each of the sprints would definitely help.
Okay.
In terms of how hard to push through the intervals, again, that comes with a little bit of experience, but you're going to want to be pushing near the top end, I would say. Like, you want to be pretty much flat out. And then the beauty of it is that there is no be-all and end-all in terms of work-to-rest ratio. The beauty is that you can change it and adapt it as you see fit. And part of that is to do with what you're training for. So for someone like enduro, it's really actually quite tough to say exactly, because like I say, and I think in Tasmania there was a minute and a half long stage, which is quite short in comparison to, say, racing Top of the World or Stage 1 finale, where you've got a huge long interval to go for. So you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket and be the 10-second man that can put down 2,000 watts, but then if it gets any longer, then you're a bit done. So yeah, does that sort of make sense? In that?
Yeah, that makes sense. And is there a benefit anyway in mixing up kind of your interval structure and length and all that kind of stuff to keep, like, almost to surprise the body? Is there actually a real benefit in that kind of variety?
Well, in terms of physiological adaptations, like any system with the body, if you just give it the same thing every day, eventually it's going to get used to what you're doing, and it needs a change of stimulus. So if you just do the same session every week, then you might get really good at that session, but then you'll stop seeing the adaptation. So you're either going to need to add on an extra interval, or you're going to have to extend the interval or reduce the rest time.
Yeah,
because you'll get stagnation in those adaptations. So you want to, in order to keep getting adaptations, you do need to keep changing what you're giving the body. But it also helps to avoid monogamy, the athlete feeling like it's, not monogamy, that's the wrong word, monotony, that's the one.
Monotony, yeah.
You don't want to make it feel monotonous.
Slightly different.
Slightly different, yeah. You don't want it to feel monotonous for the athlete. So personally, having done plenty of interval training with XC, the more it gets changed up, the better. And so basically, to answer your question, for all counts, I would say it is good to change it up, unless the athlete has a particular favorite. But then I don't think intervals are anyone's favorite. So
no, not mine,
I'm
for sure.
Take that one back.
So did you manage to learn much from the thigh measurements? Like, is there a link between elite athletes having more muscle in that area, therefore being able to develop more power as a result? Or
personally, no, but we did see it. There was a master's by research student that went before me who did see a correlation with thigh girth and maximum power output. Can't talk too much about that because it was a dissertation I read a while ago, but that is why I was taking the measurements. I didn't see it personally in Enduro, but then that was 2014 that I collected that data, between 2014 and 2016. I'm just about to analyze my fresh set of data. So hopefully I can update you on that at some point, but currently no.
Awesome.
In Enduro, no.
All right. That's all good. And what, you took the, you know, quite a lot of GPS data from the riders at the races, from, like you say, from the bike and from the athletes. And you also, I think you took kind of GPS data that is kind of just part of the EWS series anyway, because they're all wearing transducers for that. What kind of stuff have you learned from those data sets?
The GPS on its own with the accelerometer data was quite interesting, because from that we can look at split times. So it used to give us a nice map that we could split by section. And because the races that we were looking at were all held on the local trails, I could sort of pick sections that were either really technical, not technical at all, fire roads, that sort of thing, and look at split times. And basically what we found from that was that stages could be won anywhere, but they were generally won on what we would call, or what was coined by Garrett, to be the rate limiting section, as in the section that seems to have the biggest impact on the overall stage result. The interesting thing for enduro, normally it's the most technical section in a downhill race, so the most technical section has the biggest influence on overall runtime. But for enduro, we found that it didn't have to be the most technical section. It could be a fire road, which could be uphill, or it could be the most technical downhill section. So we were seeing stages that could be won on uphill fire road, but also stages that could be won on the really tight technical gnarly sections. So from that, what I took from that anyway was that the rider has to be as consistent as possible. So if you're really good at steep technical tracks, you also have to be really good at sprinting up fire roads, and you have to be really good at trail center trails, and you have to be basically across the widest range of terrain that you can in order to have the most strings to your bow, so to speak, because that's what the winning enduro rider needs.
Okay.
Because at that point, your weaknesses will hold you back more than your strengths will take you on, I would suggest, at that level.
Yeah. So there's nowhere to hide in enduro, then you can't rely on a particularly strong technical riding ability to drag yourself through. You've got to cover all your bases.
Exactly, especially if you're talking about sort of trying to win the overall. Like I did a little bit of analysis on the results from last year in the EWS.
Yeah.
And basically that was shown again that the most consistent rider is going to be the one that comes out on top at the end, because you'd have some sort of one-off performances almost where people would win stages or they might win a race that suited them particularly well. But then you always had Sam Hill or Cecile Ravenel there, and they were never far away on any stages at any point. I think the average that Sam was back or was on each winner of every stage was 1.2%, if I can recall correctly. So
right,
you put him anywhere on any stage at the EWS and he's going to be within that margin of the win. That's what it takes to sort of to win the overall. So
and especially insane,
for Sam. Yeah, for Sam coming from such a downhill orientated background, he's put in a lot of work to get to where he is. So very impressive.
Yeah.
And the same for Cecile, impressive. I would say. Cecile's trace is even better. She dominated incredibly last year. So as an all-round rider goes, Cecile's definitely just a step ahead, I would say, at the moment. But I'm excited for this season to see.
Yeah. Yeah, and rumour that she might be spending a bit more time on the downhill bike. So that would be pretty interesting to see someone go the other direction as well. Because most people have, I guess, because the fact that enduro is relatively new, people have been coming from downhill into enduro and not so much in the opposite direction. So that could be quite an interesting case study too.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it'll be interesting to see this year. I get the feeling, well, we've seen it in the past that when someone dominates like that, it was the same happened with Sam and downhill, I think, where you don't really know if they've slowed down or if everyone's caught up. So it'd be quite nice to see a bit of that this year to see if there's a bit more competition, which I believe there could be, but I'm excited to see what happens. So.
Yeah, for sure. Should be a good year. Cool. And so what's next then? You mentioned earlier you're doing a little bit of work on hand-arm vibration, but what else have you got planned?
Yeah, so at the moment I'm just looking through a lot of data I've got from the last study I did, so similar vein to having riders into the lab to test them. So put them through a ramp test with blood lactate and gas analysis at the same time, and took blood before, after, and 1 hour after that lab test, and that was before, during and after the race season. And also did that at a race where I took a resting blood sample during the week following a rest day, an hour after the race, and then on the Monday morning after the race.
Okay.
I also have heart rate variability recordings from them for most mornings, and then tried to get as much training information as I could from them as well. So Garmin data, and then a little bit of if there was any gym work done, try and capture that as well. And from that, we can look at the influence of the training and how much they do, both on their performance in lab tests and then in the field. So how well do they race, depending on what they've been doing. And then also the influence of all this training and racing on their specific cells of their immune system. So that's why I've been taking blood to do some flow cytometry and basically looking at cell surface markers on those cells. So that's all still to be analyzed and published, and well, hopefully published and looked at. But one of the things that came out of that was that a lot of the training models that are available for quantifying training loads come from road cycling, and they don't really incorporate the loading. And by loading, I mean vibration and magnitude of impacts and accumulated impacts that we see or have seen such high levels of in mountain biking.
Yeah.
So that's why now trying to capture the hand-arm vibration associated with mountain biking compared to road cycling. Because in 2016, I went to a conference where there was a presentation about hand-arm vibration in the Paris-Roubaix. So someone had ridden the Paris-Roubaix course on a fixed, like on a road bike, and they had an accelerometer on there. And somewhere in the EU regulations, there's basically something called an exposure limit value, which is when it's designed for in the workplace with vibration, where basically, say you're using a jackhammer, you get 10 minutes on that jackhammer and then you've exceeded your dose of vibration for the day. So you have to go home. Yeah. The foreman should come over and say, right, you've had enough. This is dangerous to your health. You go home. And I'm pretty sure that the ELV was exceeded on the road bike within a couple of minutes of riding on cobbles. So if I think it was something like 30 minutes of that race was on cobbles and it was exceeded that quickly, then that's something that we really want to check out.
Okay.
And it so happens that in the School of Civil Engineering, a guy called Dr. Mark Taylor has made a data bike, basically, he calls it, and it's got 5 kilohertz accelerometers on the grips, and it looks at, and it all goes into a Raspberry Pi computer, and it's synchronized with a high definition camera, and he's been cycling around different cycle paths looking at the surfaces and the influence of hand arm vibration, and found similar similar findings to the Paris-Roubaix, and basically that cycling can expose you to quite a lot of hand arm vibration.
Yeah,
but it has to be taken in a context with the fact that you're out cycling, you're enjoying, you know, the open air, and you're getting the physiological benefits of it. So I'm not going to say that it's harmful, but it's just interesting to see where it fits with these exposure limit values that have been set by the EU. And so we'd like to try and do some work in that with mountain biking and see if that maybe links up with any of the immune stuff that we've been looking at, or performance, or such like. So
yeah, well,
really, it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the arms certainly get a hard time when you're riding off-road on rough stuff, right? It's pretty, arm pumps is a pretty common complaint.
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing then would be looking at braking as your dose of vibration increases to see if there's any effect on your grip strength to pull the brakes. Because I don't know about you, but I've certainly had plenty of moments where my hands have been so pumped up that I can't really pull the brakes on anymore. And then you end up doing a big cartwheel into the woods. So there's a lot of crossover there between health and performance. So that's where I'm going next. But I'm also trying to analyze all this data that I've got from last year. So
awesome. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Nice. So we'll have to get you back on when you've learned some more and find out how that went as well.
Yeah, there's always more to learn. So
Yeah, for sure. Nice one. So so for anyone out there that's kind of been interested in hearing what you've got to say and thinks maybe they'd like to get involved in this sort of stuff, like how would you recommend people go about it? Is it a case of studying sports science and going through that route? Is that the best way in?
Well, it depends what you'd really like to do in the long run, to be honest. I know plenty of people that are very knowledgeable that haven't done a degree in the area. So it depends if you want to go into academia or research, then I think the option really is to go and do a degree and then maybe a master's and a PhD if that's what takes you. Uh-huh. And there are plenty of routes to do so. I think there's, I know that the Borders College offers the base course and sports performance. And so plenty of colleges out there offer that step between school and university as well. If it's something you're into, then I would say it's quite easy to learn about, because it is incredible what the human body can do and the things that you learn about along the way. And obviously I'm going to plug Napier and say it's a place to go if you're into mountain biking and want to study sports science, because we've got the Mountain Bike Centre of Scotland as well. So a huge opportunity, a massive resource if you want to do any research in mountain biking. So
awesome.
Good stuff. That would be my suggestion.
Yeah, we'll put some links in the show notes to those so people can find them and have a look.
Excellent. Sounds good.
Nice one. If people want to find out a little bit more and follow you, is there Instagram, or what's the best way to see what you're up to?
So on Instagram, Lewis _ Kirkwood. And on Twitter, it's Kerwood, KIRWID.
Nice one. Good stuff. Well, we wish you all the best for the rest of your PhD. And we'll have to get you back on and find out about stage two. It'd be really interesting.
Cool. Thanks very much. And pleasure to be
nice
here.
One.
Cheers.
Okay, that's it for another episode. I hope you enjoyed listening. If you did, head over to our social media channels and let us know what you thought. Also, don't forget, we've got t-shirts available on our store, downtimepodcast.com/shop. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and join our newsletter. You can do that all from the website too. Alrighty, until next time, get out and ride.